Letter from Helvetica, Series 2, is brought to you in association with georgefairbrother.com, shop.saturdaymorningpress.co.uk and synthservice.com. Letter from Helvetica by Andrew McIntosh. Starring Andrew McIntosh as John and Natalie Rolls as Abby. Chapter 12, A Hard Day's Night.
On this momentous evening, then, Mrs. Doherty's question jolted him from his reverie as though she had just attacked him with a taser. He managed to say something along the lines of, "Glarg," although I cannot be sure. He then more successfully came out with,
"Sorry?"
"Well," said Mrs. Doherty, "perhaps you would be kind enough to bring your legal training to bear on the matter and tell us how you feel we might best proceed."
Yes, well,
he cleared his throat and pushed rimless spectacles up his weaselly nose.
While I would not wish to give you my actual opinion, of course, because I can indeed confirm that no law has been broken as such, given that there was clearly no intent to offend on the night in question. So really, my legal knowledge is of minor use here.
He faded into silence like the end of a 45 RPM single. Mrs. Doherty gave him a look that could have covered Bobango in permafrost.
"I see," she said. "So it would appear that there is little action open to the council, whatever personal opinions individual members might hold. God, how I wish she would organise a coup and take over these meetings." My heart sank a little, however, when she continued, "I do, though, remain concerned that the not inconsiderable generosity of Mrs. Derrick may be withheld in future years if she feels that Beltane is no longer an event she wishes to support because of the bacchanalian behaviour of an uninhibited minority."
"Hear, bloody hear," rumbled Waters.
"Well," I said, "there is a terribly simple solution. Why don't we just ask her?" And then realised that I had almost certainly just hoist myself with my own petard.
"Yes, that would appear to be the most practical course of action," said Mrs. Doherty. "But might I suggest that we do so informally, rather than inviting her to a specially convened council meeting, because to do so might imbue the matter with more gravitas than it actually warrants."
I was detecting a hint that Mrs. D. might be of the opinion that this was all a big fat fuss about nothing, so I thought I would use a little flattery to try and press home any advantage. "I think that if you, Mrs. Doherty, were happy to undertake the task of speaking to Mrs. Derrick on behalf of the council, we would all be inordinately grateful, and I cannot think of anyone here better suited to the task." She emitted a harumph of almost imperceptible proportions, but a harumph nevertheless. "While I am more than happy to speak to Mrs. Derrick, I will do so purely with the best interests of future Beltane festivals at heart, and not because I am siding with any individual in this matter. Furthermore, Colonel Stotter, I suggest that whatever the outcome, both you and Commander Waters find a way of accepting it with a good grace, so that we can all enjoy future parish council meetings free from your infantile squabbling."
"Put me in my place, and no mistake.
You can see why she's a headmistress. Even Waters just sat there dumbly with his many chins resting on his chest like dormant lava."
When the meeting finally concluded, I wended my way to the smugglers in the interests of reviving my spirits. Jason was weaving his magic in the kitchen as usual, while Clive was serving behind the bar, and he greeted me with his customary, "Au bona tavardi, your dolly old self." And then, when he saw my face, he added, "Fuck me, you look like an homie who could do with a bijou bevy if ever I saw one. You've got an eek like a wet weekend Wigan." "It's the heavy weight of public office, Clive," I said, and explained as briefly as I could the gist of the meeting, and how I thought my clever tactic would probably backfire, convinced as I was that Lady Euphemia of Kellywig would inevitably sit on the prudish side of the fence. It wasn't as though I was attempting to promote the concept of people larking around in the nuddy at Beltane, but I instinctively balk at the likes of Choppy Waters feeling they have an inalienable right to legislate against other people's perfectly harmless behaviour. "Well, if you want to ask her what she thinks, she's in the back room," said Clive. I replied that I wasn't sure I was brave enough to preempt the actions of Mrs. Doherty, having already felt the sharpness of her tongue. However, the matter was rather taken out of my hands when both of the Derricks came up to the bar to refresh their drinks. I have already shared with you my jaundiced first encounter with Mrs. Fay Derrick. I know they say not to judge a book by its cover, but in my grizzled experience, first impressions rarely let one down, and that actually the outer shell is a most reliable guide to what lies within, particularly when it concerns people whom I take an instant dislike to. You can imagine, then, the unfettered scorn I felt as I had my first glimpse of Mr. Derrick Derrick himself, or should that be himselves, and discovered that he has, I warn you, you may need to read this through your fingers, a moustache. I have never been able to comprehend what possesses a man, or a woman for that matter, to grow such a pointless and finicky little facial decoration. Beards I get, saves you from the burden of shaving and keeps your face warm in the winter. But moustaches require to shave more, not less, paying inordinate attention not to upset the balance of this pointless little ornamental tuft. There's the trimming and the pruning and the preening and the pouting, and all in all, the inescapable truth is that men with moustaches are vanity itself. One presumes that those who sport these abominations are under the impression that it somehow enhances their visual appeal, whereas the ironic reality is that they nearly always make one look like a dodgy salesman or a 70s porn star. Furthermore, the moustache has been flaunted by some of the maddest, baddest bastards in history, viz. Hitler, Mugabe, Kaiser Wilhelm II, Genghis Khan, Fu Manchu, Dick Dastardly, and the entire Liverpool FC squad of the 1970s. There are, of course, honourable exceptions. Merv Hughes, Salvador Dali, Frank Zappa. But my goodness, they are few and far between. So with all of these thoughts spinning through my head, you should be very proud that I managed to force a grin onto my visage, albeit somewhat rictus, when Lady Euphemia turned to me without warning and said, "Hello." "Hello," I retorted. I know. Sometimes my witty responses are redolent of Noel Coward, don't you think?
"I don't believe we've met properly yet. I'm Faye, and this is my husband, Derek. Of course, we've heard so much about you."
"Ah," I managed in response, rictus grinus still intactus. Faye giggled in a manner I fancy she thinks is girlish, but is actually slightly deranged, and went on, touching my arm from time to time,
"Oh, only the nicest things, of course. We know you live in the other big house in the village. You know we've moved into Kellywig, don't you? Yes, of course you do. And we know that you had the most marvellously distinguished career, and that now you are regarded as what can only be described as a pillar of the community.
Aha, I attempted, feeling not dissimilar to the way I felt when I set off down the Cresta Run, i.e. trepidatious and out of control. And then she said, as if the thought had only just occurred to her,
"Oh, of course, and you're the one who has that Eastern European gal working for him, aren't you?"
"Oh, here we go," I thought to myself. "Here's where all this false bonhomie and buttering up has been heading. She's going to launch into me now and tell me that she's never going to shine her bounteous rays upon Beltane again, or any aspect of Helvetica for that matter, and it will all be my fault." So my equanimity was disturbed ever further when she said,
"Full of spunk, that one."
Feeling slightly dissociated from myself, I, like Roger Quirk before me, managed only to come out with the immortal word, "Glug?"
"We thought it was absolutely marvellous, didn't we, darling?"
Derek snorted and leered in agreement, moustache assuming a jaunty angle.
"When she hurled all her clothes off in such total abandonment, and then managed to persuade so many other people to do the same. Absolute hoot."
"So you didn't find it offensive?" I asked. Or immoral, or depraved?"
"What? Gracious me, what nonsense, of course not. It's absolutely marvellous that a young woman like that would feel so secure in herself and uninhibited. Absolute joy. Anyway, Derek and I are always stripping off at the drop of a hat, if you'll excuse the pun."
She gave her husband a saucy glance.
"One of the reasons we moved to Helvetica is because of the naturist beach at Peddenvounder. Always been one of our favourites."
"I have been under fire in Aden, faced the threat of the terrorist bomb in Northern Ireland, confronted the howling weather of the Falkland Islands, and, perhaps most frightening of all, endured a posting in Colchester. But never had I been quite so discombobulated until now. This, though, began to be replaced by the gradual spread of a rosy warmth as the thought took hold that in the great Stotter versus Choppy Waters battle, Stotter had just taken a commanding lead." "I'm so glad, Mrs. Derrick," I said. "Zlata is a lovely young woman, and I know she would be appalled at the thought that she might have given any offence. There were certain, concerns expressed at the parish council meeting."
"Well, you can tell them from me that unless they make naked dancing at Beltane absolutely compulsory, Derek and I won't be funding any more trophies in future."
"Oh, I will, I will." And with that she graced me once more with her disturbing interpretation of a girlish laugh and swanned off back into the snug. Derek accorded me a wink and a snort and followed obediently behind. As I type this, I have yet to experience the pleasure of passing on this intelligence to my fellow councillors, but I look forward to doing so with exquisite anticipation. Be assured I will share with you my inevitable moment of triumph when next I write. But perhaps the most important lesson to be taken from this episode is that one should never, ever judge a book by its cover, as I have always said. And so to the dogs. And it came to pass that one day, one of them, I cannot be sure which, although I suspect Moriarty, I mean, who wouldn't, gazed upon the television remote control and said unto himself, "That looks remarkably like a bone." And verily upon it he did chew, and spake unto himself, "Fuck me, it doesn't taste like a bone, but I shall persevere." T'other hound, we shall presume it to be Sherlock, failed to step in and say,
"Do you really think you should be doing that?"
but simply sat by and casually observed, for unlike his namesake, he is extraordinarily dim, even by the standards of dim black Labradors. After a great deal of chomping, the aforementioned Moriarty did pierce one of the batteries, at which he muttered, "That tastes uncommonly like a cocktail of zinc, manganese oxide, and potassium hydroxide. That's me awore the new for a wee puke in the corner." For he is an extraordinarily erudite, if villainous, Westy Poodle Cross, or a Pesty, as he is more appropriately known. One of the human occupants of the dwelling, I cannot be sure which, although I suspect the male, I mean, who wouldn't, had left the television switched on, so while this massive mastication was taking place, curses, if only I had a bull mastiff, that sentence would be so much better. The channel must have constantly been changing until finally it came to rest on something called the God Network. I mean, no offence, Gov, not looking for a fatwa nor nothing, but I have no more use for the God Network than I do MTV or CBeebies, or worse, S4C. Don't let this missive fall into the wrong hands, or I may well now have the Welsh equivalent of the fatwa, something along the lines of die the death, one presumes. Try as we might, neither Zlata nor I can figure out how to change the TV channel manually. We did try watching a programme about letting Jesus into our blackened hearts, but it was all a bit dispiriting, really, so we gave up. In the end, we concluded that we should not be such slaves to the box in the corner. I mean, who needs those reruns of faded sitcoms, the identikit American dramas, the makeover series, the shopping channels? Would we really miss the gurning breakfast TV presenters giving us their sugar-coated and anodyne version of the news, nodding at us to tell us what we should think? And as for the weather forecasters, don't get me started with their bloody mist and murk. What the hell happened to good old ordinary mist, I ask you? And while we're about it, why is there no longer such a thing as change? It's always step change, as if adding a pointless and extraneous word makes them seem more highbrow, even though they haven't the foggiest idea why the extra word's there. Bastards! As you can tell, it's not the telly that I'm missing per se so much as the chance to shout abuse at it. So we determined that our time would be much more productively spent if we were to take the dogs for long walks instead. The consequence of which is that Moriarty, or Sherlock, now believe that if they chew the remote, they are rewarded with walkies. So when the replacement eventually arrives, we shall have to guard it as though it were the Koh-i-Noor. Like to see the little bugger chew on that. Of course, one of the best and most obvious walks is down onto the sands of Pedney Vounder and simply hang a left or a right and enjoy. All pretty deserted at the moment, not even the hardiest of nudists braving this pestilential wind, Zlata included. Although it won't be long now before the lanes are choked with caravans and the villages and towns are clogged with gawping emmets. But for now, we are savouring the bracing nature of our peregrinations, enjoying watching the rolling waves of the English Channel merge into those bigger boys from the Atlantic Ocean taking a sneaky peek around the corner. And I have enjoyed pointing out to Zlata such local attractions as Logan Rock and Cripps Cove, Seggy Island and, to the west, Porthcurno Bay. We've also toiled along the coastal path so that I can show her the remarkable Minack Theatre. All of these things she has shown the most gratifying interest in, bless her. I have known others of a similar age who really could not have cared less for the delights of the world around them, preferring to focus instead on some handheld digital device or other. Shame for them. Back home, our attentions have also lately been distracted by some most unexpected and unwelcome guests. I first noticed we were not necessarily alone when I heard what can only be described as scuttling in the ceiling void above the kitchen, followed not long after by a persistent scraping sound. When the scuttling later doubled in volume and was accompanied by squealing, I had little doubt that we had been invaded by more than one Rattus norvegicus. Bit harsh on the Norwegians, giving the little bastards that name, because they sure as hell didn't originally come from there. It's not the first time that these pernicious critters have decided that Penstruther Grange is a des res, so I wasted no time and called Willy Fiddler. Have you encountered Willy? Can't recall if you ever met him during your holidays here. We probably did our best to shield you children from him, which of course is completely unfair, given that, to my knowledge, he's never been guilty of so much as a parking offence. His crime is that he just doesn't get how hysterical his name is, and adopts a bewildered and injured expression every time he introduces himself and is met with a snort and a guffaw in return. I mean, he could be William, or Will, or Bill, but no, he insists on calling himself Willy. Incidentally, reminds me of a drinking buddy I had in the 80s who was a rather unsuccessful jobbing actor by the name of Stan Bottoms. One night, while in his cups, he was bemoaning his lack of work and concomitant poverty and asked me if I thought that his name might in some way be holding his career back. I responded that I was by no means an expert on the subject, but that with a name like that it could be conceivable that this was the reason why global stardom had thus far eluded him. I didn't have the heart to point out that the most likely reason was that he was, in fact, crap. Some weeks later I ran into him again in the pub, and he told me that he'd taken my advice and changed his name by deedpoll. "Great," I said. "What do we call you now, then?" "Ray," he replied. "Ray Bottoms." Anyway, there is nothing that Willy Fiddler doesn't know about pests. He is a pest exterminator extraordinaire and has a clientele covering two counties. So I felt myself lucky that because he's local, he was able to respond to my cries of help the following day. He turned up with his young assistant, Temporary Thomas. When Willy first set up in business, he quickly realized that it was likely that he would need some help, so he turned to Thomas, the friend of his younger brother. Being a cautious man by nature, Willy informed Thomas that there was no guarantee of work and that his appointment would therefore be temporary. 45 years later, Thomas is still working for Willy and has, by all accounts, never missed a single day's work in all that time. Nevertheless, to this day, he remains known by all in the village as Temporary Thomas. Although well over 60, both men bustle about their business with enviable verve. Willy is short and wiry and slightly stooped. Temporary Thomas is tall and lean, with only a few strands of hair left on his head and veins that stand proud on the backs of his work-hardened hands. But neither exhibits any of the usual stiffness or senescence that many of their contemporaries do. Me, for instance. They stood in the kitchen and listened intently to the inevitable silence. They peered and sniffed in cupboards. They tapped the ceiling sharply. They poked and prodded around outside. "You got rats," Willy eventually volunteered. "Yes, Willy, I know," I replied, "but I don't want rats. That's why you're here." "Problem is, they're in the ceiling void, so we can't see them. We'll just have to lay down some poison and see if that works." "Oh, God, not poison," I said. "I had that once before, and one of the buggers died somewhere in the bowels of the house. The stench of the rotting corpse was so bad, we actually had to move out for 6 weeks. Cost me an absolute fortune in hotel bills, so no poison, please." Willy rasped a grubby palm across his unshaven chin.
Don't suppose you'd let us cut a hole in your kitchen ceiling, would you? We'll make good afterwards and all, but that way we can have a proper butcher's look.
I know. Everyone does a sort of mental double take the first 1,000 or so times they hear Willie's outré use of Cockney rhyming slang. I mean, first off, he's a Cornishman born and bred, and second, he doesn't quite seem to have grasped its fundamental principles. I'm sort of able to phase it out these days, and sometimes I even hear people using it right and I think it's wrong. I said he could take the whole bloody ceiling down as far as I was concerned if it meant he had a better chance of catching the little furry miscreants, or fuckreants, if you will.
You have been listening to Letter from Helvetica by Andrew McIntosh. Starring Andrew McIntosh as John and Natalie Rolls as Abby, brought to you in association with georgefairbrother.com, shop.saturdaymorningpress.co.uk and synthservice.com. The series is produced by Oliver Crocker. Co-produced by Glenn Allen, Rob Cook, Tessa Crocker, Tracy King, Paul Morris, Triona Palmer, Laura Pinifay, Lee Pointer, Valerie Rolls, Andrew Ruff, and Julia Thurlow, and executive produced by David Croft, Andrew Dyack, George Fairbrother, Edward Kellett, Bryony Kelly, Sophie Pycroft, Amanda Rotherham, Kay Scobel, and Michael Seeley. If you have enjoyed this episode, please do tell your friends. And if you'd be kind enough to leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts, this would help us climb the charts. If you'd like to hear more of John and Abby, we are accepting donations via our Ko-fi page, ko-fi.com/letterfromhelvetica.